Chris Bell, and today's date is the 8th of June, 1983, and I'm at home with squadron leader H.T. Giles at his home out in Colwood, which is just outside of Victoria. And we're going to talk about Mr. Giles' wartime career and hopefully eventually his post-war career. But to begin with, sir, could you please tell me when you were born and where you were born?
I was born in a little town in central Alberta, Gadsby, Alberta, in July 1922, and joined the service September 1940, just after turning 18.
All right, you kind of jumped the gun on me there a bit. What did your father do?
Father was a farmer until he had a couple of crop failures due to drought, and had to sell the farm, moved to Calgary, and became a maltster in the Canada Malting Company.
Malt in terms of brewing?
It brewing malt for the breweries. It's quite separate, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, they take the raw barley from the farmer and turn it into malt by the addition of hops, and then brewing it much the same as the breweries take it a step further to make it into beer.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any brothers or sisters?
Yep, I have two brothers and three sisters.
And how did you sort of fit into the scheme of things? Are you younger, older, in between?
I'm right in the middle. Right. I have an elder brother. He's 4 years older. He was in the Navy during the war. And then there's a sister next to him, and she married an Australian Air Force chap, and she lives out in Australia today. The third eldest in the family, was another girl. She's living in Edmonton. And then myself, and a younger sister that is in Creston, B.C., mm-hmm. And then my younger brother, he's still in Calgary.
Well, had your father been a First World War
soldier? No. Father had a tractor wheel, big iron tractor wheel, fall on his leg. And so one leg was 2 inches shorter than the other. He wasn't accepted for military service and had to continue farming.
Well, let me ask you this now. There's no immediate history of military service in your family. Would you have gone into the forces, do you think, if the war had not come along, or?
Oh, I doubt it.
What do you think you would have
done? If the war hadn't come along, the forces enlistment would have been extremely limited. They were all the way through the peacetime years, and unless something chaotic happened, like war, there wouldn't have been any reason to expand them, and they would have continued along as sort of the gentleman's club. Well, they were, I mean,
for
the Air Force itself, I think in 1932 it was only a couple of hundred, mm-hmm. something like that.
Very small.
Very small, yes.
And from what I understand, I think most of the work they did was almost civil service work, a lot of photo detachment work during the early 30s.
Well, they were doing mapping, yes.
Yeah.
We had a squadron in Calgary at Curry Barracks. They flew Wapitis. They were sort of one of the early generation of bombers, yes.
Not from the DH-9 sort of?
I don't know the designation of them at all. I just know they looked awful big to us as children.
Actually, there's a story recently in High Flight. It's a magazine put out by Canada's Wings, which I think you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And they told about the Wapitis, I think that's how it's pronounced. Mm-hmm. And that they were bought because the RAF didn't want them or had no use for them, and Canada could afford them. And they didn't meet any of our needs. They were open two-seat
yes.
biplanes. Slow, any other negative thing you could call them, they were, but they flew when they flew. So let's take what you could get in the 30s, I think. Okay, you said you were 18, so you were 17 when the war broke out.
Mm-hmm.
Did you immediately try and enlist, or?
Yes, but I went along during the False War period, then joined the Army, the 91st Artillery in Calgary, because they were taking recruits down to 16.
Mm-hmm.
And
with the promise of what, that you would get active service soon in the future?
Well, no, until we turned 18, nothing would happen. Everything
yeah.
was key to, you had to be 18 to enroll. Now, mind you, there was a number of people that got in before they were 18, but there was falsification of birth certificates there.
Were they sticky about that? The falsification aspect, checking things out thoroughly?
No, not too. I mean, everybody just produced the birth certificate, but then again, in the climate of the 30s, lots of people didn't have a birth certificate even, so they just said, well, Dad said I was old enough, and so here I am. And they'll bring a little note from Father that says they're 18. Of course, he was just all too happy to sort of have the lad into a career of some type.
What had you been doing at 17? Had you been in school?
In school, yes.
And what? How have you? Did you graduate high school?
No, I graduated grade 11. I would have gone into grade 12 in September when I went into the service.
Makes you sound awfully young to get into the 17, grade 11.
Well, I guess I beat it a little, perhaps 6 months, I don't know. There was one of the girlfriends who associated with my sister, worked in the recruiting office. And I had at first applied as a tail gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And
had you seen the figures of casualty rates before you would apply for tail
gunner? Well, this was still in the False War period. This first year, nothing much happened, as you recall. Mind you, it was happening in the Allied countries, but as far as the war with Britain went, it was still sort of a false war, dropping leaflet stage, this sort of thing.
Why tell them?
Just because that my qualifications as grade 11, and they said, right, you'll be able to get in earlier if you apply for tail gunner. And, so, actually, I think I just applied air crew when I first applied, but the sister's friend in the office said, tail gunners get called up much faster, and we'll put your name up to the top of the list here if you go tail gunner. So I became a tail gunner. And it wasn't until we came back from guard duty in the Maritimes.
Now you had been in the militia, you had been sent east with the militia unit for guard duty?
No, no, this was in Air Force that I changed, though, from tail gunner to pilot.
Okay.
Just to finish that aspect, and we'll go back and carry on chronologically.
Okay.
But we had already done 3 months guard duty, and this was the middle of the winter down in the Maritimes, which isn't very pleasant. And at the end of the 3 months, we were all loaded on. I did mine in St. John's, New Brunswick, at a little airport called Milledgeville, which had three Lysander Army Co-op spotters for the harbor defense guns.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent 3 months walking around the perimeter of the airfield, making like we were real soldiers, warding off saboteurs and everything.
And wearing
well, they, at the end of the 3 months, they loaded us back aboard the troop train and off to initial training school at the Hunt Club in Toronto, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
But we got off the station at Toronto and headed down to the waterfront, and we were heading to number one equipment depot. More guard duty. I remember after about 2 weeks down there, they said, right, we've got immediate openings for tail gunners to go overseas. If you want to go, we'll have you on a troop train down to the coast for a troop boat within a month or so. The rest of you, we can't give you any guarantee when the pilots and navigators will go, and it'll be sometime in the spring. This was still the middle of winter in Toronto down the waterfront. But I had already made up my mind I was going to become pilot, and so I opted to stay. And it was fortunate within a, I think it was about 3 weeks, 3 weeks to a month, that finally they drafted all the pilots, and we went on to the Hunt Club up at Toronto for our ITS. So that's how we changed from tail gunner to pilots.
No regrets, I hope.
Oh no, oh no. But it just shows you how the sort of system operated mm-hmm. at that time. It wasn't hard and fast by any means.
Well,
it was mostly, we need somebody now, and away you go that direction.
Well, requirements shifted and changed so often. It was hard.
That's right. They were changing daily, really. Yeah.
Well, especially that time of the war, the early part before Dunkirk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, tell me about this militia that you were with. We're going to deal with that first. How did you get involved with that?
Well, they were taking people, as I say, 16 years old.
This was directly after the declaration of war?
This was directly that first year of false war period.
Mm-hmm.
And all the units were expanding, militia units included. And I joined up the 91st Artillery in the spring of 1940. I think it was about March, somewhere in about there. And we used to be a little better than Saturday night soldiers. I think we went down two nights, perhaps three, and did boot camp, marching around the armories at Calgary.
Any actual work with ordnance?
Pardon me?
Any actual work with artillery?
No, no. In the summertime when they went off to summer camp, yes, I think some of the lads were actually associated with firing guns and things, but the young tads, as they used to call us, all at 18, we still had to sort of continue this three nights a week marching around the armories. And
what was your opinion of that, of the marching? Do you think it was effective for instilling discipline and
breaking? Oh yes, I think so. I think so, yes. And we had overdoses of it when we went to the Army, or pardon me, the Air Force boot camp in Toronto. We had 3 months continuous of it, and it did. It got everybody going together. And it is related a little bit to Air Force assessment systems. We had later Stainine ratings. The only problem that I could see with it, it was trying to tailor a product that was crew-oriented, that would work well as a group.
Mm-hmm.
The only problem with Stainine ratings was it screened out the bottom, but it also screened out the top, which is your geniuses. And you get a homogenous group that all goes one direction. You don't get any man that is marching to a different drum. And as I say, the Stainine rating screened him right out of the system entirely.
Did it?
Oh yes. I mean,
you would think it would almost be preferable to stream those kind of people off into fighters if they're so individualistic, put them off on their own of the plane. And if a crew, or
this could be so if it was later in the career that you were doing the assessing. In other words, after you had graduated air crew, you were doing it before. You were doing it on the entrance into air crew, because you couldn't afford to train a man with thousands of dollars required to train a man, and find out that he wasn't adaptable to a crew at the end of the period, and perhaps he would be adaptable as a single individual to fighters or something like that. As I say, it screened out both the bottom and the top. Now, mind you, it may have been an even trade-off that we got rid of the whole group on the bottom that were undesirables. But as I say, it also screened out your geniuses that normally you would have liked to have retained, the free-thinkers.
Well, it was probably still effective in light of wartime needs and demands made upon time, especially. Yeah. You know, you had to install some sort of system like that.
But coming back, drill does this, really. It is a good discipline-generating device. Mind you, our generation coming through weren't about to kick up our heels anyways. I mean, we were earning 50 cents a day or something like that, 2 bits an hour. And
a very tough decade.
3 squares a day, and you weren't on the breadline. But as I say, I was also at this particular period making application to the Air Force in July, as soon as I had turned 18.
Why Air Force now? What was the attraction?
Oh, I had always been attracted to airplanes. We used to go out to the Calgary airport and stand on the end of the runway when the little DC Lockheed 10s used to take off. They're about the same size as the Beechcraft, and we'd be right under them at the end of the runway. We thought they were Mitch machines. But this was 39, and they had been TCA had just received these were the latest thing.
Well, still passenger service was, what, 89 years old, period, around in North America? I mean, it was...
Less than that.
Yeah.
Less than that. I mean, it's, when you look back, it is quite astounding that your first crossings of the Atlantic on regular commercial bases was not till 42, thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
As far as TCA were concerned, you had some of the big Pan Am Clippers and things like that that were in the business before. But as far as TCA goes, they were flying converted Lancasters across the pond, carrying passengers, cabin ministers and everything. And here, a year later, we were into the same business on Hudson's. Those are DC codes. Liberators.
B-24.
Yeah. B-24. 25 2-inch. 24 4-inch. But it, everything moved pretty fast. And you just took it in stride. The jump from a small sort of fleet finch to a Nansen trainer, it was a pretty big jump.
Mm-hmm.
But there was the same sort of magnitude of a jump between a Nansen and into a Hudson, and from a Hudson into a Liberator into North Star. You see, these were all quantitative jumps, but people got used to it.
Mm-hmm.
You just took them in stride, really.
You told me about how you got, I suppose you were told by the RCAF that you had been accepted, and you mentioned to me off tape about how you had to go to the militia camp, or was it a base at SARC?
At SARC, yes. Well, this enrollment in the 91st Artillery had a price there just before joining the Air Force, because they insisted that I have my discharge ticket from the 91st Artillery before I could leave on the draft for Toronto with the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And so my aunt had given me a $20 going away present, and I had to use this to hire a taxi to go out to SARC camp.
Was there no bus or train that you could take?
Well, the time was pretty short. I think this was a Friday, and it was Friday morning, and I had to get this thing before I leave Friday night. Anyways, I took the cab, I know that, and I spent the hard-earned or valuable $20, the price of the cab, to go out to get the commanding officer's signature on this piece of paper that said I no longer was a member of the 91st Artillery. Actually, things were a little hectic that day, because I no sooner got back after obtaining my release certificate than we had a going away dinner at which my aunt and uncle had been invited, and we had a sort of family party. And then he was going to drive us to the station in his car. He had a car, and he had a flat tire on the road. So off the car, onto the streetcar to get to the station. But we made it. Yeah, it was a little hectic that day.
So it makes it all the more easy to remember, I guess.
Yes, it makes it easy to remember, all right.
Was it the first time you had been away from home before?
Not really. I had been in Boy Scouts and had gone to camp with the Boy Scouts once up to Sylvan Lake. That's in the middle of Alberta, up near Red Deer. Mm-hmm. And also had gone to Banff. They used to have the Boy Scouts do the caddying in the summer. So I had been up to Banff with the Boy Scouts.
Where did you go then? Where were you going after you got on the train? Was it to Toronto?
To Toronto, straight to Toronto. And it was a troop train. We got a an element from Edmonton and picked more up. I guess there were people from British Columbia that were already on the train when we got on.
Mm-hmm.
But we also picked up people, Regina, Winnipeg, all on the way. And Toronto, the whole group were...
Were they much like you in the sense that they hadn't had any basic training or boot camp training, if you like, and then they were sort of uniformed and yet really not soldiers? Not airmen?
Very few had any previous. I know in on guard duty there was one chap, he actually was my bunkmate. I occupied the top bunk because I was a little fellow, and this big fellow, he had previous experience with a Black Watch, Montreal.
Really?
And he was Army, but he wanted to be aircrew. And he was sort of wise in the ways of the world. About all I can remember about him now, he got really loaded one night and came home and sort of woke half the room up, getting into his bunk down the bottom. And then halfway through, that is about a half an hour after everything settled down, he roused himself out of there and down to the end of the bed. We used to keep our rifles with their bayonets on the end of the bed, and he whipped out the bayonet, and I figured, whoops, I was out of the top bunk halfway across the room. But he only wanted some fresh air. He dug the bayonet in the bottom of the window and pried it up. That thing settled down again. I crawled back up the top of the bunk.
Sounds like he had things all the way.
But there were very few that had any military experience, really.
Were they all young like you?
Most of them. I have a picture around someplace of all the group on guard duty down in St. John's. And there's about 40, 50 of us. I have the names of them all, but there was a notation on the back, I think. Average age was 20, 21, something like that.
Awfully young.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think only about half of them made it through the war. But it was, you know, just a typical military group picture of everybody taken those days. I know we did have quite a set to down in St. John's, New Brunswick, because half of us couldn't qualify for drinking beer in the canteen.
You're so young.
We were too young.
What was drinking age? 21? Was 21?
I forget now. I'm sure it was 20, perhaps 21. I don't know. But there was a sergeant major in charge of the guardhouse who stood up on our behalf and said, old enough to fight, old enough to drink, and got the commanding officer, a chap named Van Boncour, to sort of allow the youngsters, the tads again, have one beer, two beer a night, something like that. But that's just an indication of how young we were, because half the boys on guard duty fell into this category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was asinine to keep you from having beer.
Yeah, well, then again, you see, the general drinking age was about 21 right across the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's been liberated quite a bit since then.
To the detriment, a lot of people think, a lot more driving fatalities on
it
the road.
It could be.
He went to Toronto.
Yes, down in Toronto, there with boot camp, issue all our clothing. Everybody had a big kit bag, a couple of pairs of boots and winter clothing, the whole works. And we spent most of our time marching around the exhibition camp. We'd go all the way up to where the Sunnyside amusement grounds are,
mm-hmm.
and stop off there and have a cold drink and then start back again.
You said you spent 3 months?
3 months there, yeah.
Did you do anything that was uniquely Air Force? Because it sounds as if you did much like a boot would do in the Army or in the Navy. You know, just marching, fundamentals of military life.
I think it was strictly sort of militia, mm-hmm. continuation, militia training.
Mm-hmm.
We did do, as I mentioned, preparation of the main horse arena for a marching parade ground, and this entailed shoveling out the horse arena about 4 feet deep, and then it was paved,
mm-hmm.
and There were a certain amount of classroom study at the same time, but more towards simple hygienic lessons and air raid precautions, this sort of,
mm-hmm.
that were applicable to all armed forces, not particularly Air Force.
How were you struck by these kinds of hygienic? Because what I've seen is they seem rather crudely done and rather simplistic almost. Are they effective, you think?
Oh, I think, yes.
Do they scare the young recruit enough to be effective?
Well, it was more trying to make homogenized, average, civilized out of everybody. You know, of the whole group, you still had some people who didn't know how to use a knife and fork. I mean, when you get them all together, our group probably was better than the Army in this respect, but you still had this sort of thing, and you also had basic sort of the venereal lectures and things like this were applicable to any group, you know.
It's almost hard for me to imagine that, but I can see how it would apply, because you take someone who's grown up on a farm, isolated from society for the most part, and they're putting them in this society of several hundred men eating, and then giving them a knife and fork, and perhaps them not knowing how to use it properly. It's something that one doesn't really consider, is it? But it happens, I guess.
Oh, it does happen.
Yeah.
I can remember one chap, all he ate with was a spoon.
Really?
He never used a knife and fork all the time he was there.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, you eventually come out with a group that are sort of all going the same direction. The only thing I really remember about the boot camp, it firmly established in my mind the value of the Sally Anns. Sort of hear of other groups being involved with looking after troops, but the only thing we ever saw was the Red Shield. Mm-hmm. They were always there, coffee and donuts and things like this. And this applies overseas too.
Mm-hmm. You never hear that. You always hear about the big American USO or the Britain, the NAFTA. You never hear Canadian organizations.
Sally Anne did a wonderful job wartime. They sure did.
It's kind of funny. I associate them with the Depression, and then today with underprivileged and unemployed and helping.
It wasn't this aspect that they were looking at. They were just there for coffee and donuts, halfway along the sort of route march. And
helping out
they
the
were way. Just sort of, that's where you go, keep it up.
Did they try and any sermonizing as they handed out the donuts?
No.
No?
No, there was no sermonizing. Mind you, most of it were volunteer gals, and in the big boot camps, there weren't too many women around. Welcome diversion in that respect.
Yeah, I can imagine. What did you do after boot camp?
After boot camp, we went down again, a troop train, to the Maritimes, or guard duty.
What year are we talking? 1941?
I enrolled in September 40, mm-hmm. and we left just before Christmas in the end of 40, and spent 3 months in the Maritimes on our guard duty. I went to St. John's, New Brunswick, a little airport, Milledgeville Airport. I guess it was their civilian airport at that time St. John's, but it had two or three Lysanders with an Air Force detachment who were flying Army cooperation for the Coastal Command guns defending the harbor at St. John's. Other detachments went Yarmouth to Dartmouth in Halifax, and Sydney, Nova Scotia, on to Gander, Newfoundland.
Wherever there was an Air Force base, I guess, right?
Wherever there were Air Force bases, that's right.
Was this standard procedure that new recruits after boot camp would be sent to a base for guard duty, or were you sort of roped into being there at the time?
I couldn't say. I think we were the first, but we just sort of led the parade. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people followed because we were replaced, I know that, by another troop train group that carried on the guard duty.
What were you told? Guard this base against what? Sabotage?
I think, yes. I mean, it was very real at that time that you would have somebody blow up the hangar. I know things were very serious as far as the guard duty went. We had a commander, a guard commander, that is, under the CO, who liked to make midnight rounds, and he used to make lots of noise. A few boys let fly at him, and nothing so startling as to have a gun go off at 2 o'clock and can't see anything.
My next question is, we're using live ammunition.
Oh yes, it was live, yes sir. And this hangar that had the Lysanders was a brand new structure just put up the year before, and it was across the far side of the field from the civilian sort of ramshackled hangar, and it didn't have any airplanes anymore, but in one of the lean-tos. It had the remains of a piano, the main sort of...
strings?
Strings, rather than the keyboard things. Mm-hmm. And I know we'd get a hold of a stick and pull it across the strings. 2 o'clock in the morning, all dark, and you'd hear this way across the field. You'd know that fellow was there for a week anyway.
How many guards were assigned to that particular base?
I think there was about 40 of us. Actually, there was, there'd be six, seven sort of stations. You had a certain segment, pie segment, to do
mm-hmm.
in your patrol. And I think it was about seven, because we'd all start off sort of tandem marching, and you drop one off as you reach each station. We start off with six or eight, and then you'd be on for 3 hours on, 4 hours off, and there would be about in a 24-hour period, four-man turnover anyway, so you're looking at 50 people. We also had a wireless station to guard.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be two of us go up to this wireless station and guard it. There we were we liked that duty because we were permitted inside. And
probably was off without as much discipline about it because it wasn't a sergeant constantly over your shoulder.
No, they just the changing of the guard, you'd have to be awake for that. But the wireless station was ringed with a stelco fence and had a gate, like when you went through the gate, you locked her behind you and then you went up and stayed in the little building.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it generally was felt that anybody that would take the trouble to go over this 8-foot fence would be more than you could handle anyway, so we didn't worry about them. Actually, it had a secondary sort of advantage because we'd play around with the equipment and all we could get was the Morse code, you know, I mean, it wasn't the broadcast band, the Morse code, and in that period I learned the Morse code, which we had to learn in ITS later on, and a lot of boys had real trouble with it. They could barely get to about five words a minute on it. This grounding up at the wireless station served me in good stead because I was sort of 20 words a minute moving right along on Morse code. Never did me any good other than getting through ITS, but it got through on subject.
Although it's good on the resume.
Sure. Well, I still know it, but I don't listen to code anymore.
How long were you there for?
We stayed 3 months and then returned again on the troop train that was collecting all the people in the Maritimes, ostensibly going to ITS in Toronto for our basic aircrew training. But when we got back to Toronto and they formed us up in the station, we started to march east when we knew that the ITS was up at the Hunt Club up at the end of College Street, and we knew we weren't going towards the Hunt Club. It didn't dawn on anybody until about halfway through this little route march that we were heading for the equipment depot. Sure enough, more guard duty down there. And this was still wintertime Toronto. I guess it would be, let's see, sort of the end of March into
still
May.
Cold.
It was still cold. But all I can remember about it was we were sitting under a great big white rose gasoline. I don't know whether you recall it, but they had a big white rose as their symbol, and they had this duplicated in lights down at the waterfront. And we'd stand there all night and watch the lights blossom out into the big rose. We always used to try and count how many lights there, but the sign would go off and then flash again before we'd get through covered. But about 2 weeks after we were there, they announced that anybody who would volunteer tail gunners, they could get a draft immediately overseas. They needed tail gunners in a hurry, and the remainder...
Sure, Brits, I should think, not with Canadian.
I don't know. The remainder who wanted to be pilots or navigators, their turn would come, but they weren't guaranteeing anything. We might have to be guard duty another 6 months. That shook everybody. But I stayed behind, and it was about...
Why so adamant?
3 weeks later. Pardon me?
Why so adamant for pilot training? I mean, you...
I don't know.
Because you'd gotten in with the idea of, well, at least initially getting in, becoming a tail gunner and getting overseas, I suppose, and get flying.
Yeah.
But somehow you had changed your mind during your guard duty of training. But you thought this war had been going on a little bit longer than I thought.
Well, I always wanted to be a pilot, and the only reason that I sort of... volunteered air gunner in the first place was in order to get my name up to the top of the list because they were taking air gunners then. Same idea as at the equipment depot with the guard duty. They wanted air gunners again, and you could have sort of made it overseas short order if you wanted to go that route. But as
well,
I said,
the question is getting your nose in the door or your foot in the door. And then,
yeah.
Yeah.
My end objective all along had been become a pilot. I don't know. Nothing else had appealed to me too much along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the chaps that were going navigator were the sort of mathematics, higher mathematics, people who liked mathematics.
Who liked to work with figures.
Yeah. Figures and things. Actually, you get into sort of taking astral shots and things like that, and you did get into a fair bit of algebra and mathematics and tables and stuff.
How did you work easily with figures, or was it difficult for you?
Oh, a bit difficult. We had to take it in IPS. We had to sort of get up into certainly high school graduating maths and into first year as far as formulas of flight go and things like that. But you want something bad enough, you stick to it.
You know.
Most of it rude learning as far as I was concerned. I wasn't too much experimental thinking. No, as far as taking an astral shot, you just rude learn the number of steps. Well, he told me at step number 3, I got to go to the book on page 49, and so we look up page 49, run down this column till we hit the number of degrees that the little bubble says are in there, and then come out with a line. Somehow it works. I don't know how it works.
As long as you follow the method, you get the right answer.
That's right. Yeah. And so long as I got the right answer out the test questionnaire, that's all I was worrying about. I wasn't worrying about having to apply this later and find myself up in the air. This was the furthest thing from my mind.
Was the Air Force happy with your decision, i.e., did they agree with it? Did they allow you to pursue the pilot training unhindered? Or
Oh, yes. We came out of IT.